You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
10 koto katoa, ko shimena toku ingwa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mo tēnei rā. Hello, welcome to The Wire for Wednesday, the 26th of July. I'm Shimena and I'm joined in studio by my producers Ruben and Will. How are you going, guys?
We're doing good.
Yeah, good. Good afternoon.
So coming up today on the show, producer Ruben McLaren speaks to Chloe King about hospitality, migration and the living wage. We hear from Tracy Martin from New Zealand First, who joins us this week to talk about the Auckland teachers shortage. This week on Dear Science with Alan Blackman, we speak about an attempt by ISIS to build a dirty bomb in Mosul and reports from the police linking synthetic cannabis use to deaths. Producer Will discusses mental health and health media with Canterbury University's Ekant Veer. And Katie Doyle talks about the use of social media content being used by broadcasters in their reporting. As always, give us a call 5395 if you want to have a chat to us or... Wait, wrong way round. I did that last week. 093879, in fact, is the number to call. 5395 is the number to text.
The Wire.
According to a Radio New Zealand report released today, hospitality bosses say they are struggling to get locals to apply for jobs and need skilled migrants to stay in the country to keep the industry going. Hospitality workers have hit back, saying that if they want more New Zealand staff, they need to pay more. I speak to Chloe King, a hospitality veteran who has launched a workers' campaign called Raise the Bar, and asked her if she thought hospo bosses are struggling to employ Kiwis because the pay isn't attractive enough.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Like, there's been like a massive bar boom in Auckland, for example, but there's been absolutely no boom in our wages, regardless of our experience, as was illustrated in that Radio New Zealand report by a hospo worker called Bella, who had 15 years' experience in hospo. She was only offered $20 an hour, and I've got about 12 years experience in hospitality, and I'm really ever offered anything more than minimum wage or just a dollar above. So if you pay us poverty wages, then expect us to work incredibly hard for almost nothing. That is predominantly the reason why we're over it. We've had enough, you know? Like, that's why they're struggling to attract New Zealand workers, not because we're lazy or drug-addled or whatever. Yeah.
So do you think Kiwis are in competition with migrant workers?
Absolutely not. I think that migrant workers have every right to come to this country on visas, on student visas, and eke out a better life for themselves. I think the pitting of workers against each other, particularly low-wage workers, is just another way for us to compete against each other for shitty wages and jobs that are not that meaningful, when we should be banding together and organising ourselves as hospo workers and standing up to bosses who pay poverty wages and treat us as nothing more than units that... of production to exploit.
So in the RNZ report released today, Aisha Green, who has worked in the hospitality industry for 12 years, said employers like migrant workers because they were cheap and compliant. What do you make of that?
I think compliant is not the right word. I think the word scared would be a much better word. And yeah, overwhelmingly, migrant workers do become part of the black economy, which is being paid less than minimum wage under the table, which means even though hospitality is already the least regulated industry with almost no union representation, they have even less rights and less ability to negotiate and have fairness at work. Yeah, so I don't think the cause of wage suppression. Wages have always been incredibly low in hospitality. It is the lowest paid industry in our country. That is not new migrant workers' fault.
Do you think migrant workers in the hospitality industry are being abused?
Yeah, absolutely. So I launched something called Raise the Bar about 4 months ago. It is a campaign that aims to advocate for hospitality workers. I give out free legal advice. I've taught myself employment law. I'm aiming to raise the conditions of hospitality workers. And yeah, like without a doubt, they're just being treated appallingly and they're being abused. I talk to migrant workers nearly every day on the ground who are in the backs of kitchens who are just being treated appallingly. And it's a national disgrace as far as I'm concerned, yeah.
So what do you think needs to change?
So overwhelmingly, first of all, hospitality workers need to start organising themselves. If they'd like to do that, they can contact me through Raise the Bar. I am pushing to connect hospitality workers with each other so that we can start a movement that pushes bosses to pay us equally and fairly. They can also start demanding. They can start demanding things also from welfare, like a insecure work benefit, because overwhelmingly we're stuck in precarious work in hospitality. We're offered casual contracts, which offer us absolutely no consistency of hours. So if we can get our wages topped up, it means we're more empowered, and it means we can start pushing back against the injustices we face. So yeah, just get hold of me and start teaching yourself employment law. That's another thing. Like, once you know your rights, once you know where you stand, you can start fighting back. And I'm happy to come and advocate.
So it sounds like you're forming a union.
Well, not necessarily. We do have a union. It's called ETU. The union reps I've talked to are quite supportive of what I'm doing. I've been part of the End the Zero Hours campaign with Unite Union. It's more of an advocacy campaign in which we peer-to-peer as hospitality workers back each other. I will teach employment law, and then we go out to bat for each other. So it's more of a peer-to-peer campaign where we fight for each other. Yeah.
So I've read that you're advocating for the implementation of a living wage. Could you expand upon that?
So a living wage right now sits at $20.20 an hour. A living wage is the basic hourly wage you need to survive, to be able to pay bills, rising living costs, rising food costs. Anything below that is what I consider poverty wages. Any employer paying any employee below a living wage is forcing them into poverty, and that's not okay. That's not a country I want to live in. And workers deserve fair pay for fair work. That's not much to ask for.
So advocacy and policy manager for hospitality in New Zealand, David Firth, says that increases in wages can be difficult for hospitality businesses to absorb, and that a sudden increase to a living wage could require a dramatic shift in their operation. And others say that an immediate increase in wages will mean that they'll have to cut staff. What do you make of this?
Well, so I do understand that. I can see that from, you know, the boss class's position. I've worked for Lila Harrier, who's, you know, a politician and also a unionist. She paid a living wage at her restaurant that I worked for. She did say it was hard, but she managed it. Do you know what I mean? She paid all her staff a living wage. It can be done. We know it can be done. And overwhelmingly, it doesn't have to be straight away. Like, I mean, the Green Party have got policy around slowly bringing up the minimum wage to a living, you know, hopefully aiming for a living wage. But you know what? Like, what's worse? The fact that you're paying your staff so poorly, they're living in poverty. We're actually just paying them a decent wage. And it's really hard to believe that when nearly every place I've worked, I've been told my employer cannot afford to pay me a living wage as they drive off in their $60,000 car to their holiday home. It's really hard to swallow that sometimes. Yeah. So I think it needs to change.
So do you think if businesses are relying on a model that relies on cheap labour, do you think it's just a bad business model?
Of course it's a bad business model. All it does is it exploits predominantly the working and lower classes, traps us further into poverty, traps us into a precarious way of life. Like, over, you know, the CTU sites that 30% of our workforce are actually stuck in insecure work. We've got 600,000 people stuck on the minimum wage in this country, and we're wondering why poverty is rising when we've got rising living costs. Like, it's really time that we shifted towards higher wages, better work conditions, and stronger unionisation for our workers, particularly in hospo, which is one of the most insecure industries you can work in.
What do you make of Labor's proposed policy to implement a slowdown of migration?
I think, once again, that is scapegoating. That does not address the core of the problem. We've had low wages that do not match inflation since we started introducing neoliberal policy nearly over 30 years ago. The problem is poor policy. The problem is an unregulated industry that has no unionisation. Migrants are not to blame for wage stagnation. Wages have been stagnating since the 80s, you know? So that is a lie, and it's an easy out.
So in the context of the coming election, what party's policies do you most agree with?
Overwhelmingly, I do agree with the Green Party's policies, particularly around their new welfare policy, which would see welfare be increased by 20%. You could also earn up to $200 with their policy while on welfare without having your welfare cut. That would move closer to what Matt Harris, the academic, has called for, which is an insecure work benefit, which would help the precarity in industries like hospitality. So I do think the Greens use the least neoliberal language. They are the most aligned with the working class, and they're about the only party offering up policies that would strengthen workers' rights. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we've got Labour Party's Future of Work, but I don't know if they really fully understand what precarious work is and what needs to happen to change it. Yeah.
Do you think maybe Labour hasn't gone far enough?
Yeah, I fully agree. They also talk about basically cultivating more resilient workers as if it's up to individual workers to become resilient enough to survive a shitty workplace. And what we need are higher wages, better work conditions. And we also need the government to step up and actually start monitoring properly. You know, businesses, they're not doing a good enough job, ultimately. Like, I mean, employers are, with impunity, breaching employment law daily, you know, and that needs to change. It's not fair and it's not right. No one should be working, regardless if that's part-time or full-time, and be poor at the same time. It's that simple.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
That was my producer, Ruben McLaren, speaking to Chloe King, campaign organiser for Raise the Bar.
Now it's time for Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
Good afternoon, Tracy. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. That was really interesting listening to Chloe just then. I couldn't agree with her more.
Yeah, she's
about things.
Very articulate young woman. So shall we get into talking about the Auckland teacher shortage that we're currently experiencing? We've heard a bit about this over the past couple of years, but it's recently been brought back into the news from a new survey of primary and intermediate teachers in Auckland that says two-thirds are thinking about or planning on leaving the city. 64% of all new teachers have given up on the prospect of ever owning their own home. Many are postponing parenthood, all down to Auckland's high living costs. Do these results surprise you?
No, we've known that they've been coming for a while. I mean, I'd have a lot to do with our local college, Maharangi College. And I mean, we've been suffering and complaining to the ministry about our difficulty in finding specific teachers, like in math, English, science, and so on and so forth, for over 5 years. The fact that this is now, and that was a skills shortage. Now we're adding in a housing shortage or a house, you know, out of control house prices into what we already had, which was a skills shortage.
Mm. So what you're hearing from teachers kind of corroborates the survey in that people are saying not getting paid enough in terms of my teacher's salary, living costs are too high, therefore I'm looking elsewhere for work.
Yeah, well, they can't afford to. They can't afford to live at a standard that they believe is acceptable for them as New Zealanders, and I don't think that their standards are too high, on the pay that they're receiving in the area that they're trying to work. So they're just saying, well, my pay can go further in another space, so I'm going to go and try another space.
Mm. So in terms of the solution for this problem, what do you see as the fix? Is it just simply as simple as raising the wages of these teachers, or what's the New Zealand First's view
issue? I'm actually not a proponent of raising the wages of teachers in a particular city, because wages should be based on skill, and now we're arguing that with pay equity, right? So wages should be paid on the skill of the individual, and a trained and qualified primary school teacher in Ekurahuna has got the same level of training and skill as a primary school teacher in Auckland when they come out first. So first of all, we need to address the pay scale, and that's something that we haven't been addressed for a long time, is the actual pay scale of teachers across New Zealand.
Wait, so you're to cut in there, so you mean with that, you mean for it to increase more quickly as they progress in their career?
Well, yeah, not necessarily progress more quickly, but we haven't. Is the starting salary the appropriate starting salary now? I mean, how long has it been since the pay scale has actually been looked at? And at the top end of the pay scale, definitely at the top end of the pay scale, it's nowhere near what it should be for somebody of the experience and qualifications that our primary and secondary teachers have got. So we need to have a conversation about the pay scale overall. With regard to Auckland and other cities that are going to start to feel the same pressure, we would like to have a conversation with the sector about recruitment and retention payments specifically for housing costs. So, you know, that we set a criteria and we look at the capacity that we have to actually provide that recruitment and retention funding. It was taken away, strangely enough, a few years ago, and it was used to be used to source teachers from overseas. We now need it to actually retain teachers in certain cities in New Zealand. But add to that as well that New Zealand First wants to remove the student debt from our trainee teachers, from our teachers. So that's 12 cents in every dollar over a certain amount that they have that comes out of their salary to pay back their student loan. We want to put that 12 cents back into their pocket and have them use their skills to pay off that investment inside New Zealand rather than actually take another 12% out of their salary.
So earlier in the month, Education Minister Nikki Kaye, so she accepted, yes, we're a little bit short in Auckland, 300 teachers short, which is about 1.5% vacancy rate. Although she did say this rate was not necessarily unusual for any workforce and that they've announced a range of initiatives to put in place to try plug this gap. So, for example, a $5 million increase to the Teach First New Zealand program, as well as advertising campaigns and scholarships to encourage science and maths graduates to become teachers. What do you think about these policies? Do you not see these as being enough?
Well, no, first of all, when we originally started this question, it was about primary school teachers. And I think it was only 5 years ago that a whole cohort of primary school teachers from one of our teachers training colleges, teachers training facilities, was told by the Secretary of Education that there was no work for them, go overseas. So that's the first thing. So now we've got a shortage of primary school trained teachers, right? Teach First NZ is apprentices in front of our children. That's not an answer to a shortage of qualified and registered teachers. It's just not a solution. So, you know, Nikki has finally accepted. I mean, I've been in the House here this year alone where she has said there is no problem. There is no teacher shortage. And now, again, a bit like the housing crisis, finally the national government has listened to the sector and said, well, okay, all right, we accept there's a problem, and they've come up with solutions that aren't solutions to the actual problem.
I mean, the Teach First New Zealand students, though, they're all high-achieving university students who then go through a specific program to be trained for teaching positions. I mean, they're not just sort of some... Joe Bloggs plucked from the street into an apprenticeship position, you know, so that they have been vetted initially.
Yeah, I understand. I sat on the bill that allowed Teach First to do this. What they are is, and this is not about them, the graduates, this is about a government that allows this to happen. So the Teach First NZ graduates have bypassed a one-year teacher training and had an eight-week course over a Christmas period, and then they are in the classroom. Now, the small number that were in prior to this, prior to the government actually passing legislation to give them protected positions inside our secondary schools, everybody else has to, their positions have to be advertised. Teach First NZ graduates have protected positions now inside secondary schools. And they, so they get these protected positions and they learn on the job. They were supported, the small number previously were supported by the University of Auckland, incredibly well supported by them, don't get me wrong, but the University of Auckland has pulled out of that support. So they're now hunting around for a new support provider, and you cannot get away from the fact that after 8 weeks of in-classroom training, you might be brilliant at science. That doesn't mean that you understand the pedagogy of learning and that you can communicate your knowledge into and change it into learning for a young person in that classroom. They are apprentices on the job.
But, I mean, they do have a small amount of actual contact time with the students. A lot of the time that they do spend in the classroom is in a mentorship sort of capacity. So
no.
Surely in the classroom that's the best way to be able to learn.
That's not true, Shamina. The Teach First NZs are not trainee teachers, all right? So training teachers or beginning teachers that we already have the capacity for inside the legislation before this change was made worked with mentor teachers. Teach First NZ are very much on their own in the classroom as opposed to buddy teaching. They're on their own in the classroom more often than not, and then they certainly have somebody inside the school that they can go to outside the classroom. but it is not the same level of mentoring support that beginning teachers and trainee teachers have had previously.
Okay, but I mean, getting back to the initial concept, though, of a teacher shortage in Auckland, surely this Teach First New Zealand program could be improved, and that will help sort of plug the gap, as opposed to scrapping it completely and continuing with this shortage. You know, this is one sort of possible alternative means, and sure, there are some criticisms that have been made around the program, but don't we need programs like this to be able to help fix those shortages that exist in a city like Auckland?
Wouldn't it be smarter to do some workforce planning so you didn't end up in a shortage area rather than lower your standards?
Well, this is something that Nikki Kaye did say on The Nation earlier in the month, that she has approached the Ministry of Education that's something that she wants to do. So, I mean, this could be on the cards shortly.
Well, that's lovely. After 9 years, they might think about doing workforce planning when only 4 years ago they removed any requirement for workforce planning out of legislation with regard to education.
So,
I mean, you know, I think that's an amazing turnaround for the Minister of Education now to say, oh, I'm going to get the Ministry to have a look at workforce planning, when 4 years ago they put through a piece of legislation that said we're removing any responsibility for workforce planning inside the education sector.
Hmm. Well, I guess there is, you know, possibly that they've sort of realised I don't know too much about that specific instance, but we do know, like Nikki Kaye has said herself, that this is something that she wants to do. So I guess looking forward, possibly that is a priority for the national government. Also, we've got, just going back to the initial press release or the study released by earlier this week, we've got a quote from Balmoral School principal. Hang on a second. Balmoral School principal Malcolm Milner, who's a union spokesman on the issue. So he said that the government should divert unspent money tagged for new communities of learning to raise teacher salaries or give teachers incentives to stay in Auckland. So what are your thoughts about the communities of learning policy and how that's going? Do you agree with Milner in this instance?
Well, yeah, New Zealand First never felt that $359 million aimed at another administrative level on top was necessarily a good spend of money. So we're not sold on $359 million at the top end. We would much rather see that money spent, similar to NZEI, I suppose, at the front end on young people. But I think he has a really valid point, that what is the crisis at the moment? The crisis is the workforce and the maintenance of that workforce, the retention of that workforce. So the communities of learning is actually not going as well as the government thought it would, because they've tried to be too dictatorial. Schools already were working collaboratively, and now they've been told how they will work collaboratively. So, I would agree with him. I would agree with him that now's a moment to take $100 million or something like that out of there, and I haven't done the numbers off the top of my head, but take some of that money that's not being spent, because the coals are not going anywhere near as fast as they thought they would.
Well, thank you very much for your time today, Tracy. We'll talk to you again next week.
Bye, Shamina.
That was Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party. The Wire.
From Academy Award-winning Dutch animator Michael Dudok de Wit comes the first ever international co-production with beloved Studio Ghibli. The Red Turtle is a visually gorgeous fable. Beginning with a man marooned on a desert island, it moves into ever more extraordinary territory, from turtle-thwarted escape attempts to a truly magical and forever life-altering occurrence. Don't miss the majestic world of The Red Turtle, out now on DVD and digital thanks to Madman Entertainment.
Late at the Museum is back for a 10th season of Curated Evenings. Join moderator Noel McCarthy for Late, Home Sweet Home, A Question of Immigration, an evening exploring the experience and effects of migration in New Zealand. With an eclectic panel and performances from Friday Night Bites, Late is entertaining, informative, and bent on challenging mainstream discourse. Late at the Museum, Home Sweet Home, A Question of Immigration, Wednesday, August 9th. Book your tickets now at aucklandmuseum.com.
Have you guys heard about BFM's Winter Dump?
Even in a housing climate where living under a rock is becoming an increasingly viable option, everyone's heard about 95BFM's Winter Dump, right? It's only the most incredible, life-altering, heart-embiggening prize pack this side of the Bombays. So hold on to your mittens, kids, because these fully sacked prizes could be yours.
Fresh fruit and veg delivered to you for 3 months from Farrow Online.
A year's supply of Go Healthy Verdefense vitamins.
A year's supply of Karma Cola.
A weekly meal for two all winter at Mexican Cafe.
A $500 shopping spree at Def Store.
A winter prize pack from O Natural.
A gnarly Olympus action camera thanks to Pro Gear.
A gorgeous champagne flight for two over Auckland and Rangitoto thanks to Auckland Seaplanes.
$500 to spend on new gear at AS Colour.
Custom skis from Kingswood Skis valued at $1,350.
And a weekly feast of southern fried vegan chicken at Lord of the Fries.
95BFM Winter Dump is on now, so get entering. Go to 95BFM.com.
And I just keep the flow coming, this is strictly for the soul, cousin.
West is best and Mellow Downs can prove it. Mellow Downs Avontales EP release, Whammy Bar, Saturday, August 5th. Avontales does just what it says on the cover, weaving together stories of Avondale life into an intricate web of sound like a rap spider. To celebrate, Mellow Downs is getting together a lineup of local hip-hop royalty with Bailey Wiley, Shiraz and LSJ, Rizvan and Diggy Dupe, Tom Scott, Ill Baz and more. How could you not be keen? Mellow Downs, Avontales EP release. Whammy Bar, Saturday, August 5th. Pre-sales from Eventbrite.
こちらは 95BFM オーディブルワールドです。
World music treats and bizarro ethnomusicological finds with Andrew McLeod and guests.
Look at Jim Foley, the name FM Bicolon Tonduru Nana.
Let your ears bathe in all the splendor of the planet's oral delights. The audible world, every Sunday night from 9 until 11 pm.
Ascoltate il mondo udibile, Radio 95 BFM.
Hey boy.
Hey girl. Can I grab a 3/4 flat white, not full to the top, with a shot of syrup? The one that smells like teen spirit. Cheers.
Yeah, no problem. Have hair or to see me go?
Have hair is fine. Can I just grab a spoon, man?
Trackuccino. Every day on breakfast, Mikey digs back through the crates and serves up a special track from a special time. Listen in for the chance to win a couple of free Coffee Supreme coffees from your favourite local. Trackuccino on breakfast, thanks to Coffee Supreme.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can f*** off.
Yes, now we have AUT's Alan Blackman joining Will and Ruben and I in the studio to talk about some science news. How are you this lovely Wednesday, Alan?
I'm very good. Can't complain. It's not
you
raining.
Sort of said that and like unsure, like, I think I'm good. Yeah. No complaints.
Well, I'm never sure how to answer that question. Yeah.
Well, I guess, yeah, there is the default answer like, yeah, I'm good, when you're actually like kind of shit inside.
Indeed.
You don't want to like go into the big spiel. It's just like, let's make this easy. Say good. Anyway, so first up, we see that archaeologists have discovered evidence that Aboriginals have been living in Australia for at least 65,000 years, which is a little bit longer than previously thought.
Indeed. So up until, I guess now, people had thought that the Aboriginals arrived in Australia around about 50,000 or so years ago. And a lot of this is based on a dating method that probably a lot of you have heard of out there in radio land called carbon dating or radiocarbon dating. And the way that that works is that you use this to date things that were once living. In other words, basically that they're based on carbon. So things like trees, wood, all that sort of stuff. And the carbon component of that, or the radioactive carbon component of that, because there's a little bit of radioactive carbon in all sources of carbon, and that eventually decays away once the object stops growing. Once it's died, then that starts decaying. And from the amount of this radioactive carbon isotope, carbon-14, that's left, you can figure out the time since whatever it was died. So the trouble with radiocarbon dating is that it only works over a time period of around about 50,000 or so years. And anything longer than that, it's pretty much useless because all of the carbon has decayed away after that time. The carbon's got a half-life of about 5,000 years. You can use this method for 10 times a half-life. So what they need is a possibly a better method of dating objects. And so what they have got in Australia, what they've used, is this thing called optically stimulated luminescence, which sounds fantastic. It's kind of cool. And so with respect to this recent discovery, what they found was a batch of artifacts, about 11,000 artifacts, and they're all buried in sand to a depth around about 2.6 metres. And what they've done with this is that the sand that's surrounding these artifacts, they can figure out the last time that that sand saw the sun. In other words...
That's a mouthful. last time the sand saw the sun.
Yes, alliterative too. So they can figure out that, which means that they can figure out the time since those items were buried.
Mm.
Okay? And the way that this works, in brief, is that the sand, the structure of sand, which are just quartz, should be perfect, but it's not. It's got little imperfections in it. Okay? And in these little imperfections, you can get electrons stuck. And the way that they get stuck there is that they absorb light from the sun, and some of these electrons get stuck. And when they get buried, they can't get unstuck, basically. Mm. So they're sort of stuck in these holes, we call them, electron holes in the quartz. And it's not until the sand then gets exposed to light again that those electrons can get out. And when they get out, they just pop out a little bit of light as well.
Mm.
Okay? And if you analyze the intensity of that light, you can figure out how long it's been since the quartz or the grain of sand or whatever last saw the light. So that's the technique that they're using for this. And so now they're dating this to around about sort of 65,000 to 80,000 years since Aborigines inhabited Australia, which means that all of the anthropologists around the place are going to have to rethink their dates for the time when humans left Africa, because that's what happened.
Totally.
That's where we all came from. So we all came from Africa. And so this is going to push the dating of that back probably another sort of 15 to maybe 30,000 odd years. And it's also got the effect of saying that the early Aborigines must have interacted with a bunch of megafauna in Australia for a lot longer time than was previously thought. So they had things like giant wombats and stuff in Australia, which people thought that as soon as the Aborigines came in, that everything got killed off by the Aborigines. But that doesn't appear to be the case now. If these numbers are correct, then that means that the Aborigines were coexisting with these megafauna for a lot longer period of time. So it's a, you know, fascinating scientific technique that they're using, and it's got real big implications for basically the history of humankind, I guess.
Right, I see, because the article that you sent spoke about the out of Africa theory, so that's what you're referring to with that, that actually has massive ramifications beyond just sort of learning a little bit more about Australian Aboriginals. It's way, way bigger than that.
Yeah, so basically, you know, back to where we all came from, and so the timing of that is all important, and now the timing of that's certainly got to be looked into again because of these results. Mm. So, you know, very, very nice work. And the beauty of this is that it's in Kakadu National Park up in the Northern Territory, this place, and it's completely owned by the native Aborigines. And so they basically control the entire archaeological dig. And so everything belongs to them, and you know, I think that's pretty cool. They're not getting their sort of culture stolen or anything like that. So
what exactly has been found there using this dating?
Yeah, from what I could see, it's a whole lot of sort of stone implements. So they found the oldest, I think, ground axe head. So instead of just sort of chipping it off like flint, so they've actually ground it to a sharp edge, which is, you know, kind of a rarity for that time. So basically, most of the things were stone. There's a fireplace as well, so they can use the radiocarbon dating there for however accurate that is. But primarily, you're looking at minerals, and that's where this process, this new method, is very, very good.
Right. So they dug and found these artifacts,
yep.
And then the electrons that were buried at the same level.
Yes. Yes. Yep.
Okay,
yep,
right, so yep. They shone light, and then they were like, okay, yeah, gotcha.
That's exactly
this
it.
Is my, this is my my non-scientific summary of like...
Simplified optically stimulated luminescence, yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
So there you go.
And like carbon dating, is there a limit on this new way of dating? Or does it have like a
Seemingly not, actually. It's not dependent on the amount of an isotope like carbon dating is. So my very, very small knowledge of it, I don't think so. I think this is okay. It just depends on the number of electrons that it's actually got in there trapped. And provided there's enough to get a decent signal out and you can integrate that signal, then there shouldn't be any limit, I don't think. Mm-hmm.
So now our next story comes from a great titled article by The Independent in the UK, which was ISIS failed to build dirty bomb because they, quote, aren't that smart. So tell me a bit of background about this. What's this all about?
Okay, well, I guess the science content in this is a little bit minimal, but the stupidity content is just off the scale, I would say. But anyway, so everyone's heard of Mosul, horrible place to be in over the last X number of years, controlled by ISIS, and it's been recently liberated by the Iraqis with a bit of help from the Americans, etc., etc. And it was known when ISIL took over Mosul that there were a couple of machines in the university there that relied on the radioactive isotope cobalt-60. And so these machines are basically for the treatment of cancer, okay? And that's what cobalt-60 is used for. So it's very, very intense radiation, and you can basically kill cancer cells using this. Obviously, because it's very, very radioactive, then it doesn't only kill cancer cells, it kills normal cells, etc., etc. So what I guess everyone was fearing was that ISIL was going to get their hands on this stuff, stick it into some sort of a normal bomb and disperse it very rapidly over a populated area and thereby condemning everybody to radiation sickness, which is what a so-called dirty bomb is.
Okay.
So it's not a nuclear bomb or anything like that. It's just a normal bomb, but you're just spreading radioactive stuff all over the show. This cobalt-60 is nasty radioactive stuff. And so that was the fear that ISIL would come up with this. Thankfully, it didn't happen. So after they liberated Mosul, they went to the university and they found that these two caches of cobalt-60 were still there, thankfully. Then some guy from the health ministry went and said that that ISIS never managed to build a bomb because they're too stupid, basically. Now, number one, my question is, why was this reported at all in the media? I mean, what's the point of reporting this? Because all it's going to do is make people aware of the possibility of this sort of dirty bomb thing going on. It's going to get them worried. And number two, don't call people stupid because they'll just try and prove you wrong. You know, it really didn't seem to be the most sensible thing in the world to say. So thankfully, I guess, at the moment, the world is still devoid of dirty bombs, but the fact that this has gone all around the world and has been reported all around the world, does that increase the chance of a dirty bomb being made?
Totally.
I would have thought it would have, but I'm just a chemistry lecturer, so what do I know?
And I guess, you know, the situation in Iraq as well is not obviously the most stable.
No, indeed not.
So it's kind of like, it's, you know, is that kind of a dumb thing to publicise? We've just got Mosul.
Yep.
You guys forgot about this thing. Shame, but...
And, you know, there's radiotherapy machines all over the world. There's cobalt-60 sources, you know, everywhere. There's nuclear medicine departments and all sort of, you know, decent-sized hospitals all around the world. You know, if you're really, really serious about it, of course you can get your hands on some nuclear material, radioactive, whatever. So let's just hope it doesn't happen.
So when you say you just put this radioactive material in a bomb and then blow up the bomb, is that literally how simple it is? You don't need to have really much scientific background.
Well, you've got to not kill yourself with the radioactive stuff to begin
with.
Very
important, yes.
That's kind of the limiting step, hence the not very smart comment, I think. Because, you know, implying that they couldn't sort of get the cobalt out of the shield without killing themselves.
Right, so you need some sort of knowledge. Not
you
any,
do, yes, yeah. you do, yeah, yeah. But really, you know, theoretically, that's all that you have to do.
Do we know if ISIS knew about the cobalt?
I've got a feeling that they did. I thought that in one of the articles I read that the implication was there that they were making threats that they might be doing this. So, yeah.
What? In regards to their intentions, why would they actually even do it, though? I mean, they would caused the whole city to be radioactive, and what's the point of having a city that you can't live in?
Well, maybe they just, I don't know, fly to Baghdad and drop it over Baghdad. I don't know. I mean, we're trying to explain the minds of...
Yeah, I guess yeah. Like, if you're intent on destruction...
Then it doesn't matter
to
because...
To fuel fear in, you know, through the media, then...
Yes.
It's a possible action you might consider.
You know, if we can't have the city, then you're not going to have it either. No. Yeah.
So just quickly moving on to the final story today, we're talking about the synthetic cannabis epidemic. Sweeping New Zealand and Auckland police have reported that it's killed people. What are some of the issues around calling it synthetic cannabis firstly?
And that's exactly my point on this. Now, you know, drugs, that's your choice. You want to do it, that's totally up to you. But... this stuff is being sort of spoken of as being synthetic cannabis when it's nothing of the sort. They're totally different materials. And labelling it as being synthetic cannabis sort of speaks to it being somewhat benign as cannabis is. So you're saying it's some derivative of cannabis. Now, if you want to get into the science of it, the reason perhaps that these things are called synthetic cannabis or more correctly synthetic cannabinoids is that they go to the same areas in the brain, the same receptors in the brain that cannabis does. Now, the stuff in cannabis that makes you feel high is this thing called, well, one of them anyway, is the thing called THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, which is a molecule, and a molecule that's got a particular shape that fits into the cannabinoid receptors in the brain. And these cannabinoid receptors were found sort of around about the 1980s, and there's two different types of them. And that's what happens when you're smoking dope. So people have been interested in making molecules that seem to have sort of similar effects or bind to the same receptors in the brain as do the psychoactive materials in dope. And so there's a guy by the name of John Huffman, Professor John Huffman from Clemson University, who spent 20 years basically making a lot of these molecules which appeared to do the same thing as cannabis, certainly bind to the same receptors in the brain as cannabis does. And they were very, very different chemically, very different chemically from these cannabinoids. So that's sort of the reason why they're calling it synthetic cannabis, because these molecules that he made, they're quote-unquote synthetic rather than occurring naturally. But supposedly they're acting on the same centers in the brain as cannabis does. So he himself, this guy, said you'd have to be crazy to take these things. Okay, they've done lots of studies and everything and trying to figure out the way the brain works, et cetera, et cetera. So they will have done lots of, you know, animal studies, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're smoking this stuff, you just don't know what's in it, number one. You know, that's the thing. So the police are saying they've found traces of weed killer, fly spray, that sort of stuff. And it's not related to cannabis. And if you think it's safe because it's got cannabis in the name, then think again, because, you know, 7 people died last month with this stuff, supposedly. So it's the name that I am just so opposed to. I think it's horrible. Call this stuff what it really is, but don't call
it anything.
Unknown
chemicals.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Oh, look, here's something that you don't know what it is. See what this does. You know?
Well, the media aren't helping either, because I've seen articles where they're showing literally cannabis, normal cannabis, and saying synthetic cannabis is hurting people. So everyone's looking at normal cannabis and being like, oh, it looks like the normal stuff.
Indeed.
I can do it anyway.
Yep. And, you know, it's, to my understanding, I've never actually seen it, but, you know, it's just sort of plant material that, you know, made up to look up like dope and sprayed with whatever psychoactive substance these rogue chemists, and sadly they are chemists, are making these days.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and of course part of the problem is because we don't know what it is, we don't know whether it's legal or, well, we know that it's not illegal because in order to be rendered illegal, it's got to have a particular... chemical structure. We've got to know actually what the stuff is. If you don't, then you can't make it illegal.
Well, exactly. I mean, that isn't that the whole thing with these, I mean, these legal highs that the manufacturers are kind of always one step ahead of policymakers, and so just making little tweaks here and there.
Yes, absolutely.
And then having to, then the policymakers just always trying to have to catch up.
Yes, yeah. And I think we talked about this a few months ago with pea and this derivative of pea that is now seemingly flooding the market. That's not illegal because nobody's made it illegal, but, you know, it's one chemical step and bam, you've got pee. So if you've got the precursor, you can very easily make pee. So we're fighting a losing battle on that one, sadly. Mm. It's all got to be retrospective.
Yeah.
It has to be. You know, you find this dangerous drug on the streets and then you make it illegal rather than the other way around. So, and of course, making it illegal doesn't stop things anyway. So witness marijuana. So.
Yeah.
Do you think this just gives credence to the calls for legalizing actual cannabis?
I feel like logically right, but then who really knows? Because I feel like it's almost such like a moral issue in New Zealand, and we can't really move past that. Well, we haven't been able to move past that, but yeah, I mean, I feel like logically that makes sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a debate for another day, surely, but everyone around the world seems to be heading that way, so I think probably New Zealand will end up going that way as well, and then you can monitor it, you can regulate it, you can tax it.
All of these great things.
Yay, tax.
Indeed, but you know, it might make things safer, but God, that seems like a poor reason to have to do it, doesn't it? Because we've got nasty stuff out there.
Right. Yeah, no, you're right. But it's like, oh, I guess we'll make it legal because of the dangers of synthetic cannabis, when there's actually all of these other really robust arguments around the legalization of
absolutely.
Cannabis that have been
agreed,
you know, talked about for years now. If this is the thing that does it, it's like, ah, oh well. Well, thank you very much for joining us once again, Alan.
Not a problem.
We shall chat to you again next week.
Cool. Okay, see you guys.
That was Dear Science.
The pleasure magenta are a dark and unstable clown, and your mind is a long balloon. It will be twisted into all manner of surprisingly unpleasant shapes. The pleasure magenta are a beautiful peewit, and you are a teenager circa 2008. Your heart will break, they will not return your calls. The pleasure magenta, in your dreams cassette release, Wine Cellar, July 28th, with support from Wax Channels and Terracotta Cat, $10 on the door.
From Academy Award-winning Dutch animator Michael Dudok de Wit comes the first ever international co-production with beloved Studio Ghibli. The Red Turtle is a visually gorgeous fable. Beginning with a man marooned on a desert island, it moves into ever more extraordinary territory, from turtle-thwarted escape attempts to a truly magical and forever life-altering occurrence. Don't miss the majestic world of The Red Turtle, out now on DVD and digital thanks to Madman Entertainment.
The wait is over. Swidit's new album, Stony Hunger, is out this Friday. Swidit are putting Onihunga on the map, taking over New Zealand radio with bangers like Silver Scroll nominated Little Did She Know and No More Parties in Stony Hunger. No wonder they're 95 BFM's album of the week. Don't miss Swidit's Stony Hunger, out this Friday on CD and digital. Tune in to 95 BFM Breakfast all week for your chance to win a copy.
You love music, right?
Yes.
Then drive your stake into the musical landscape by voting for the 95BFM Top 10.
But how?
Text the word VOTE and your chosen band's name to 5395 or vote online at 95bfm.com/top10 before 6pm today. Then join Pearl from 7pm as she starts counting them down. The 95BFM Top 10 with your host, Pearl. Tonight from 7 o'clock and always online at 95BFM.com.
What do you think, Olivia?
Yep. I think that I just spilt buttered chicken down my top is what I think.
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
I love that sting. Those are our previous Wednesday Wire host and producer, Daniel Walker and Olivia. Great bands. Anyway, next story today, Will is tentatively waiting for me to stop rabbiting on to introduce the story.
Thanks, Jimena.
You're welcome.
Mental health is an issue that has been greatly talked about over the last few months, with acknowledgement of its massive impact on New Zealanders beginning to be addressed in mainstream media. However, we do have a ways to go, with New Zealand's suicide rate still being one of the highest in the world, with the men's rate being especially high. I spoke to Ekant Veer, a lecturer on marketing and media from Canterbury University, about his lecture tonight discussing this issue. I asked him why mental health issues seem to be so underaddressed in Kiwi culture and media.
Sure, it's a really difficult thing for me to answer in like 30 seconds, but it is a combination of a lot of things. Most importantly, I think, is it's become a cultural thing, it's become such a taboo, it's become such a stigma to discuss mental illness and to discuss the issues associated with mental illness that as a result, we kind of just ignore it. If I broke my legs walking out of my house, there would be no issues with someone getting a cast put on and me even taking painkillers to take the pain away. But if I was struggling with my mental health, then a lot of people just don't want to even think about it, don't want to talk about it, and definitely won't go and admit it to their partners or their friends or anything like that. So we need to find a way that we can break the stigma in a healthy way and encourage people to seek the help they really need.
Do you think New Zealand is worse at that than a lot of other countries? Because it is part of our culture, and especially with men, it's sort of this lag culture that you don't talk about your feelings and you keep those sort of things bottled up. Is that an issue that's very important to New Zealand rather than other places?
Yeah, I mean, if it's not important to New Zealanders, then it really should be, because we have the highest teen suicide rate in the developed world. We have a significantly higher male suicide rate in New Zealand compared to many of our normal cultural partners like Australia. I think Australia is like 54th when it comes to male suicide. I think the UK is 123rd when it comes to male suicide. We're 34th in the whole world, developing and developed countries, when it comes to male suicide. So this is something that we really need to start thinking about a lot more and taking more seriously. Now, what causes that is a complex issue, but it needs to be taken seriously, not just by individuals in society, but by our leaders and our politicians as well.
Do you think that the fact that we don't publicise or acknowledge suicides that much in sort of mainstream or media that's shown to everyone, is that something that's influencing this, or is it deeper than that?
It's a really complex issue. I mean, I am not a fan of publishing suicides. I understand the reason for that. We know that there is the potential for copycats when we do actively publish suicide. And this is part of the tension that we're discussing in this lecture tonight, in that if we start talking about this too openly, we can almost glorify it and make it seem like it's a cool thing to do. And you don't want to go that far either. The problem is, when you completely shut down not just the media, but also the community talking about this sort of issue, then it does increase the stigma and it does increase the taboo. And when you have that taboo, people don't feel able or open enough to talk about this with people when they really are struggling and they really do need help.
Yeah, I feel like it's sort of a double-edged sword there. If you don't talk about it, then it's not brought into the public eye and people aren't aware of the issue and don't address the issue. But if you talk about it too much, then like you say, it does become glorified.
Absolutely. And so there's a number of really good investigative journalism pieces that are being put out that really take a conscious and a nuanced approach to this that doesn't glorify it. And I think we need more and more of that, but it's becoming difficult with the way that the media is being forced to put out quick articles rather than in-depth, long-term articles. We also need more of our politicians, in my mind, talking about this. We need more of our local government talking about this. And we need the funding to support those people who are really working on the front line of this every single day.
How do you think media could have a massive impact on this situation? What sort of ideas and discussions need to be put through mainstream media to help this issue?
Sure. So let's take a really easy example, which happened about 4 or 5 months ago when Jono on the Jono and Ben show shared about his friend who took his own life. And it was very emotional, very heartfelt, very authentic display of emotion and loss from someone towards their friend. What we do know amongst men in particular, when they saw that, there was a real outpouring of support, rather than vindication or toughen up, man up sort of thing, which a lot of people are afraid of. When we can have the mainstream media, when we can have even pop culture talking about this in a nuanced but also authentic way, you're going to see a lot more people think it's okay to feel this way and it's okay to seek help for this and it's okay to use the services. One of the problems we have in New Zealand is that a lot of people know that services exist, but very few people are willing to access those services. So we need to find a way where we can break that stigma, where someone can actually admit to themselves, yes, I can't do this on my own, yes, I need help, and here's how I can get help. So all the money in the world going to the doctor isn't going to help if no one ever goes to the doctor. We need to get them to that step.
Yeah, I feel like you said earlier about if you broke your leg, people are going to care about that and they're going to help you directly. Yeah. I feel like mental health doesn't get the same treatment at all, and it is a health issue. It should be treated with the exact same sort of respect and understanding. And I feel like in New Zealand a lot, there is this sort of ingrained thought process where this is an issue that's put to the side and it's not addressed with the same scrutiny, I guess you could say.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's hard to pinpoint exactly what it is, but I think the British background, the stiff upper lip sort of, you know, keep calm and carry on perspective does contribute to that. I think the fact that we have a lot of comfort guilt in this country, I shouldn't feel this way because people around the world are suffering so much more than me. The reality with mental illness, it doesn't discriminate based on comfort or background or culture. It discriminates based on you being human. So if you're human, you have the potential to suffer this way. And it doesn't matter what's going on in your life, you can feel crappy at sometimes and great at other times. And so it's about addressing that, understanding those triggers, and working out a way that you can actively and consciously find solutions to that for your own well-being, but also the people around you. And this is part of what I'll talk about tonight as well, is how can people start supporting their friends and within their community, and how you can be part of a community in order to support others when you see their behaviors and their functions start to change a little bit and you think that's not quite right.
And so what is your lecture tonight? And I mean, if you could give details, that'd be great for our listeners as well.
Yeah, no problem. So the lecture tonight is sort of a culmination of about 4 or 5 years worth of work, working with different agencies and talking with people who suffer from mental health in New Zealand, trying to understand why is it so difficult to promote mental health in a positive way? Why is it so difficult to get out there and encourage people to seek help when they need help? So the work that John Kerwin did to open up the discussion with his advertising campaign is a great example where people started thinking, oh, we can talk about this now, but it didn't solve the problem. And this is part of the problem, that advertising can start the conversation, but it doesn't change culture. And what we need to do to change culture is start looking at more individual level and small micro community level changes that we can find improvement. So I talk about trying to disentangle identity and mental illness. So just because you have a mental illness doesn't mean you're less of a man or less of a mother or less of a son or less of a daughter or whatever else it might be. This is something that affects you, and it doesn't mean that you're a less of a person as a result. But we also talk about trying to disentangle control. A lot of people aren't willing to give up control associated with their mental illness, with their identity, with their well-being, because it might feel that they're going to be stigmatized as a result. So when someone goes to their doctor and says, I need help with this, they're essentially saying, I can't cope. I am out of control. That's very difficult for someone to do. That's very, very difficult, especially with our staunch British upbringing that a lot of people might have in New Zealand and the sort of societal norms about get over it, harden up, man up, whatever else it might be. Very difficult to admit, I can't do this on my own. So we need to find ways that we can do that. And so the sort of things I talk about are building micro communities of support. So small little groups, small little gatherings where you can support one another. You don't need to be a therapy group. No one needs to be a professional. But just keep an eye out for your whānau. You keep an eye out for your friends. You keep an eye out for your workmate. And if something changes, you can talk to them in an authentic manner and say, is everything okay? And I want to help you through this, rather than suck it up, sunshine, you know, take a teaspoon of cement and harden up, and those sort of things that people are afraid of. But I also think that we need more people who are willing to talk about this in an open, authentic manner, who can be seen as, this is okay to be this person and have mental health issues. This is okay to suffer through this and still be successful in all these other ways. We don't need to suffer about it. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I remember there was this really good Australian campaign where it wasn't directly targeting those affected by mental health themselves, but the people around them, and saying that it was okay if your friend is looking like they're struggling or if they're looking like they're distant from other people, to go up to them and say, hey, are you okay? And I feel like that's a massive issue, even potentially more so than the people who don't want to talk out themselves. It's about people embracing that opportunity to discuss mental health with friends.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem is that people who are struggling with mental health feel that if they did speak up about this, they'll be ostracized, they'll be told they're less of a person. If those people around them are actually saying, I want to help you, is everything okay? Are you struggling right now? We try to use these terms, struggling, rather than are you ill or anything like that, because it's a little less stigmatized to say struggle rather than are you sick, are you broken, or are you crazy, and all these other things people think they're going to say. But if the community is willing to embrace that person and say, I'm here to help, are you struggling right now, and I genuinely want to help, then it helps people to feel still part of community, even though they are struggling at that time.
That was The Wire.
Yes, that marks the end of another Wednesday show. Unfortunately, we ran out of time to play Katie's interview with Belinda Moffat about Broadcasting Standards Authority have come out with news that social media users do not like the media using their social media posts. Unfortunately, we ran out of time for that, but hopefully we might play it on the show tomorrow. Thank you to everybody, though, who spoke with us for the pieces that we played today. Chloe King, Alan Blackman, Tracy Martin and Ekant Veer. Thanks heaps to Will and Ruben for helping with producing this morning. And thank you very much for everybody who tuned in. Just before we head off, we're going to continue our new Wednesday feature we decided to do during the outro. Fun facts. So take it away, Ruben. What's your fun fact?
So there was an octopus named Otto who caused an aquarium power outage by climbing to the edge of his tank and shooting a jet of water at a bright light that was annoying him. He's also been seen juggling hermit crabs, throwing rocks at glass, and rearranging his tank surroundings.
Wow. I have so many questions. But anyway, we're running out of time. Will, what's yours?
Well, the feeling of euphoric chills some people get while listening to music is called frisson, and researchers have described the sensation as a skin orgasm. So listen to BFM.
For frequent skin orgasms. And my fun fact for today that I learned is that cows have best friends.
Oh.
Isn't that beautiful? I know. Anyway, thank you all for tuning in today. Up next is Bridge with the 1-4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.